Good morning and welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. It's the weekly program about health, fitness, nutrition, and all things lifestyle. I'm Tim Henney. Lynn Werpeek is on assignment, and I'm being assisted and supervised by Bob Hendricks. Bob, the listening audience, thanks you for the assistance and the community for the supervision. First, I'll play an interview Lynn taped with Dr. Martin Gabala about the health benefits of high-intensity interval training and his book, The 1 Minute Workout, Science Shows a Way to Get Fit That's Smarter, Faster, Shorter. And then in another taped interview, Lynn and I speak with Jennifer Wright about her latest book, Get Well Soon, History's Worst Plagues and the Heroes Who Fought Them. And finally, I'll speak with Wendy Cohn and Summer Sanders Schlope about Running with Ed, which happens this year on May 20th. This is The Mountain Life. We'll be right back.
American Roots on KPCW is proudly supported by Donna Van Buren of Greater Park City Properties, managing HOAs in Park City, Canyons, and Deer Valley for 30 years. Greater Park City Properties can be reached at hoa@greaterparkcityproperties.com.
Grab the family and head out to Soldier Hollow in Midway to enjoy some winter tubing and cross-country skiing. We invite you to explore the 1,200-foot tubing lanes and the 34 kilometers of cross-country ski trails featuring immaculate grooming and varied terrain for beginners to expert skiers. Soldier Hollow is a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing sport and recreation opportunities and a KPCW supporter.
Dr. Martin Gabala is a professor and chair of the Kinesiology Department at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario. His research on the physiological and health benefits of high-intensity interval training has attracted immense scientific attention and worldwide media coverage. Let's join Lynn as she discusses his book, The 1 Minute Workout, with Dr. Gabala in this interview she taped before leaving on assignment.
Martin Gabala, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thanks for having me on.
High-intensity interval training. So, you know, I think we've all known as athletes for a long time that there's this thing called interval training out there. But we do think it is, and you mentioned this in your book quite a few times, we think it's reserved for those Olympic athletes. And here in our little town in Park City, we have a lot of those. So when you see someone speeding by you on the track, you always figure, well, they're an Olympic athlete. They're doing intervals. That's them, not me. You debunk this myth.
You're right. Intervals have been around for a long time and largely the domain of elite athletes. Any serious endurance athlete already incorporates them into their training. But if there's one thing that we've learned, and certainly over the last 15 years or so, that's that interval training is not just for elite athletes. It comes in many different flavors. It's been applied to many different individuals, including cardiac patients, people with type 2 diabetes and metabolic syndrome, and obviously normal average people and weekend warriors as well. So there's a type of flavor of interval training that's suitable for almost anyone, and it's rooted in time-efficient training.
Okay. So time-efficient training, our busy lives, you know, time efficiency is something perhaps trendy, perhaps not. But it seems to me when I read, you know, first it was Gretchen Reynolds with the first 20 minutes and, oh, we've interviewed about the burst workout. We know now that sitting is the new smoking and really it takes less and less time. Help me, well, explain to me why this is not a trend that's just letting us off the hook for spending a lot of time getting fit.
Well, let me say, you know, there's no free lunch at the end of the day. And so if you want extremely time-efficient exercise, it tends to be uncomfortable exercise. So these very short, very hard bursts of exercise can be an uncomfortable way to train, as your athlete listeners would well know. So again, at the end of the day, there's no free lunch. But I do think that intervals, regardless of the type, provide a time-efficient way to boost fitness. And I think that's just a reaction to the reality that the public health guidelines are based on great science, of course, but 80% of us are not listening. And so if we can identify some time-efficient exercise strategies that confer benefits, provide more menu options, if you will, or more menu choices for people to pick from, we think that's a good strategy for public health.
Yeah. So I would imagine that, as you say, there are no free lunches, and we do have to do the work overall. Something that concerns me is about the idea that some people are going to say, well, all I have to really do is, you know, 1 minute of exercise and a couple times a week, and that's great. I'm worried about people going out and doing a big sprint up the stairs and, like, not being warmed up and, you know, snapping their Achilles tendon or something.
No, it's a fair point, and clearly it is a bit of a teaser headline. You know, the one-minute workout comes from research that we've done that's involved 3 20-second hard efforts. Now, some of those hard efforts are just climbing up the stairs, you know, with a short warm-up and cool-down. So you're right. The risk is that people just read a headline and say, oh, I can do 1 minute of exercise, and that's going to provide all of these benefits. I hope, though, that what the book allows is opportunities like this to try and provide some nuance to the message or explain it a bit more. And you're right, there's many different types of interval training. We always want to have at least a short warm-up and cool-down, but in our research, we've shown that even as little as a 10-minute time commitment, start to finish, so that includes a short warm-up, a short cool-down, and a little bit of recovery in between these, for example, 20-second sprints, can be really effective. We've studied it with stair climbing. We've shown that, for example, people who do these 3 10-minute sessions a week of exercise can have the same benefits over several months as people who are doing 150 minutes per week of the continuous moderate approach. So again, our message here is that intervals can provide a time-efficient way to boost or maintain your fitness, and they also provide a more convenient option for many people to fit exercise into your life rather than having to structure your life around exercise, because I think we have to be realistic, whether it's an excuse or a valid reason, because a lot of us do lead very busy, time-pressed lives. People are not following the traditional advice, and so let's provide them with some other options that we know are effective.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Martin Gabala. His book is The 1 Minute Workout: Science Shows a Way to Get Fit That's Smarter, Faster, and Shorter. Well, Martin, let's talk about the science in just a second here, but I want to start with your personal experience. And this is sort of how you, I guess, stumbled on this. And then you did the research around it. And you're sort of known for the science behind this concept. But talk about your personal, your anecdote about how you got into it.
Yeah, when I first started out, I was a busy young professor. I have a working wife, and we had 2 young children, age 1 and 3. And ironically, for an exercise physiologist, I was finding myself with very little time to exercise. At the same time, I was teaching a senior course in integrative physiology, and the students were always interested in the training regimes of elite athletes. And we would talk to people like Roger Bannister, who was a very busy medical student, and he used to train on his lunch half hour, basically, with some intervals. And I thought, you know what, maybe there's something there. And that really led to this personal interest and also a professional interest in studying more time-efficient ways to get fit.
Okay. And what exactly is going on in your musculature when you're giving high-intensity intervals?
We still don't know everything, and that's certainly what keeps me interested as a scientist, or what are the mechanisms happening here. But I think a way to think of it is, when we exercise, this triggers a whole bunch of signals inside the muscle, and that leads to literally remodeling of our muscles. So we turn on these signals that cause changes in genes, and we build these new proteins, and that basic fundamental system can be triggered in a couple of different ways. Certainly the traditional continuous moderate approach for a prolonged period of time, that can trigger the system, but we also can trigger essentially the same results by having these short, hard bursts of exercise. So if you want to think of it in terms of a fuel gauge, one of the ways is you can push moderately on the pedal and hold it there for a prolonged period of time, and the fuel is going to go down over time. And as that fuel gauge warning light comes on, it starts to tell the body we need to do some things here to make some adjustments. But another way is we can basically push down on the pedal quite hard for a short period of time and drop the fuel gauges very, very quickly, and that seems to trigger many of these same adaptations. Obviously, if you're an elite athlete, it's much more complicated than this, and we try to dial in very specifically what's going to work for you. But if you're an average, everyday individual, again, even a weekend warrior, that's basically as simple as it is. We can trigger the same processes in different ways, and it also speaks to the need for varied training. So varying it up is always good because you're challenging the body in different ways.
So talk about things like glycogen level, for example, in the muscles. You know, that's something that we try to eat right while we're doing for example, a long bike ride or a long run to keep those glycogen levels high. What is the difference? Obviously, I mean, that would be something, it seems to me, that has you've been able to chart.
Yeah, we can. And so one of the, for example, the fuels that are monitored is glycogen availability in the cell. And we know, of course, that muscle glycogen levels go down when you do continuous prolonged exercise. But you can drop muscle glycogen levels quite markedly in a short period of time with these short, hard intervals. And so that would be a classic example of one of these proteins that are sensed or monitored. And as glycogen levels drop, that triggers some of these other processes to turn on. And so there's a whole fascinating body of research now looking at, you know, should you quote unquote train low or should you specifically try and reduce muscle glycogen stores prior to certain levels of training. And we've done some research there as well. For example, if you have people do two interval sessions, morning and afternoon, and you manipulate their carbohydrate availability in between. I think there's subtle effects of nutrition. Generally, the exercise stimulus is the overwhelming signal. But clearly you can manipulate the timing, the amounts of nutrients, and have some subtle effects on the adaptive responses you see.
Okay. So how about VO2 max? Are we able to manipulate that by doing high-intensity interval training?
Absolutely. It's one of the most time-efficient ways to change your VO2 max. So VO2 max, of course, is just the maximal rate of oxygen use by the body. It's mainly determined by the health of the cardiovascular system, the ability of the heart and lungs to deliver oxygen through the body. Intervals are a very effective way to do that. You have to, you know, it looks like when it comes to improving VO2 max, intensity is very important. Obviously, you get to a point as a highly trained individual where VO2 max sort of plateaus. You know, it's a bit like a mortgage. There's a fixed element and a variable element to it. The fixed element is based on our age and our sex and our genetic capacity to develop a big heart. But the variable component comes through training, and we know that more intense interval exercise training is one of the best ways to maximize the increase in VO2 max. There's some classic studies from the 70s where there was a mix of continuous exercise and very, very hard intervals and showed, for example, that you could double your VO2 max in some individuals in a period of a couple of months.
Wow, that's impressive. Well, let's talk a little bit about endurance activities. I've got to tell you, Martin, I'm an endurance athlete from a long time ago. I mean, I love those 12-hour events, you know, going through the night, adventure racing. And I've always thought that, you know, a long, slow slog kind of gets me there, right? But this turns everything upside down. It turns that thought on its head. And I will say that the one couple of month period that I did CrossFit and then went and did my endurance cross-country ski race that was just a couple of hours, I was more fit than I had ever been doing that race. And so I'm kind of a believer. But talk about how, you know, can you get endurance from doing high-intensity interval training?
Yeah, absolutely you can. You know, I'm often asked the question, could you train for a marathon by doing exclusive intervals? And my response is, yes, you could, but I don't know that you would run the best marathon that you have in you. And so if you talk to elite coaches and elite athletes, by and large, the traditional approach is still about 80% traditional high-volume base-type training and 20% intervals because, again, they're a very challenging way to train. So, you know, on the one hand, I think the traditional approach to endurance exercise still holds. Now, for individuals who are time-pressed, clearly there's some, you know, outstanding examples of athletes who have been able to be very successful in a time-pressed schedule, and by and large, they adopt an interval-based approach. You know, also there's this nebulous concept of overtraining. You know, whether it's more related to intensity or volume, I think is quite debatable. But suffice to say, you can have significant improvements in endurance capacity in a time-pressed manner, even if you're a highly trained individual.
Okay, so lots of highly trained individuals out there in this town. What about those folks' parents, for example? My 76-year-old mother, you know, how would you, what are the caveats of your approach for someone like that? And obviously, what are the benefits as well?
Sure. A couple thoughts. Obviously, number one, be smart. You want to see your physician before you start or change your exercise routine. Point number two is interval training is not this all out as you hard as you can go or these very extreme versions. Again, that's one type, but it comes in lots of different flavors. And so if your only exercise is walking around the block, an interval workout for you is picking up the pace for a few light posts and then backing off. And as simple as that sounds, there's research to show that interval walking boosts fitness, improves blood sugar, and reduces body fat better than a comparable amount of continuous steady-state walking. So I call it just gentle hills and valleys. Just slightly changing up the pace will tell people, just get out of your comfort zone a little bit. You know, you don't have to go that hard, but relative to what you normally do, just push the pace a little bit. Again, interval training comes in lots of different flavors.
Yeah, I like that. So what about the number of intervals that we would do? At what point are you beyond the point where you're going to recover?
You know, don't want to hedge, but it depends on lots of things, in particular the intensity of the interval. And so, you know, if you're going very hard, you don't necessarily have to do many of them. If you're backing off more, then, you know, there's basically this inherent intensity-duration trade-off. The lower intensity, the greater the duration the intervals need to be in order to reap benefits. But there is a point of diminishing returns, and so just doing a couple of intervals is going to provide a lot of bang for your buck. You know, 10 intervals will provide marginally greater benefits. But again, if you're time pressed, you want to keep it short. The analogy is a bit like weightlifting. You know, if you do 3 or 4 sets of bench press, that's going to give you more strength gains than one set of bench press. But you get a lot of bang for your buck with that one set. You know, I think when it comes to intervals, you have to do a couple of intervals for them to be beneficial. We've had some studies, for example, where we compared a few intervals versus one single effort that was matched for the total amount of exercise, and the intervals were better. So there's something to this intermittent nature of the exercise that appears to be important. But again, if you're talking time efficiency, you want to restrict it to a couple of intervals, or otherwise you lose that time efficient benefit.
This is such great stuff. It's the 1 minute workout. Science shows a way to get fit that's smarter, faster, and shorter. My guest is Martin Gabala. Thank you, Martin, for joining me on The Mountain Life.
Appreciate the opportunity. Thanks for having me on.
Miller Orthodontics is a proud supporter of The Randy Barton Show. Since 1988, my wife and I have provided a combined 45 years of orthodontic care. For our Invisalign patients, we provide digital scanning and imaging technology that eliminates the need for wet molds of your teeth. More information is at m2ortho.com.
Hi, this is Chris Eggleton.
And Chris Retzer of Destination Hotels Utah, proud sponsor of KPCW.
Since 2005, we've provided nightly rental, retail, and community management services
to New Park Town Center, Prospector Square, Empire Pass, and Touhey.
More information about Destination Hotels Utah is at dhutah.com.
Well, Lynn and I have interviewed Jennifer Wright before and enjoy her irreverent look at various aspects of history. We talked to her a year ago about her book, It Ended Badly, 13 of the Worst Breakups in History. She joins us again in this taped interview to share this discussion of her new book, Get Well Soon, History's Worst Plagues and the Heroes Who Fought Them. Jennifer, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's so interesting that you chose horrific plagues to write a somewhat witty and entertaining book about. What's up with that?
Well, I always want the books I write to be as accessible as possible. So in my ideal world, people would talk about history the way they talk about Beyoncé's pregnancy. So usually what I end up doing is I compile all the facts first, and then I go back through the book and I try to find a modern-day pop culture figure that people might recognize when they think about this person, or some movie that they might have seen that they could immediately recognize when we talk about a different era in history. So I just want there always to be footholds throughout the book that make it something other than an academic sterile book. And humor is a wonderful way to do that.
I should say so. I mean, there's not a lot that's humorous about syphilis, leprosy, tuberculosis, smallpox, the bubonic plague.
You missed typhoid.
Typhoid, yeah. Polio. But somehow you make it so. And what we get from you, as you say, is we're hooked into this book about these horrific diseases and plagues that, that destroy so many lives. But let's start with, how you're received at a cocktail party when you tell people that you're writing a book about plagues. I thought that was funny.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, a lot of times people want to leave to go get another drink. It's not always the first thing that people want to talk about, especially when I offer to show them pictures of what someone looks like when they have syphilis. So my fiancé has been very nice about coming home every year for dinner and immediately listening to me say, let me tell you everything that happened with the bubonic plague. But, you know, I think from a 21st century perspective, the way people approach these things and the human responses were so fascinating and so unpredictable. And when I assumed that we'd get progressively better at handling plagues throughout history, I was so surprised and intrigued to find that that was not the case at all. There's no way to predict when people are going to be compassionate and pragmatic and sensible, and when people are just going to panic and start burning their neighbors as witches.
So, Jennifer, I'm along those same lines of you coming home and telling your fiance every little detail about every little plague. I'm wondering sort of your reason for going into plagues, as Lynn was asking. Is it because it's just a fascinating study and trivia that or is there some bigger goal that you want your audience to walk away from reading the book with? Because it is chock full of amazing facts. And, you know, the fact that there were 40,000 lobotomies from 1930s through the 1970s,
I bet
people wouldn't. I mean, who would know that?
Well, I love trivia. So, yes, definitely that's part of the appeal for me. But I started writing the book when the Ebola outbreak was happening. And it seemed like every time I turned on the news, there was another story about how Ebola is going to come to America and it's going to kill us all. And I like to learn about things that I'm worried about. So I started reading a lot of books about plagues in the past and trying to figure out, all right, so if a plague does come to America, what are techniques that have worked well? Who emerges seeming like a hero in the face of plagues? Who emerges seeming like a villain? What are techniques that cause plagues to spread faster? So I always believe that the more you know about any subject, the better prepared you are to tackle difficulties you may confront in the future.
And so you've packed the book full of examples and stories, and you deal with different plagues. How does that translate to from the past to what we're dealing with today? We have the Zika that is on the forefront, and we just talked to somebody about vaccines in our last program and the race to create vaccines to combat these plagues and outbreaks and epidemics. And then there's AIDS, which we've been dealing with for decades now, which is still an issue in our society. So how does your history of the past translate to what we can apply today?
Well, one thing that I think I learned very clearly is that societies do very, very badly when they either try to shame people for having a disease, as people did with syphilis, because people will try to hide it and they will end up spreading it to a lot more people. Or when societies try to ignore a disease, as Reagan tried to do with the outbreak of AIDS. He never mentioned it until 1985, by which time thousands of Americans were dying per year of AIDS. And the same year, he ended up cutting funding by 11%. So I think talking about things early, getting the media involved, a terrible problem with the Spanish flag plague was that Woodrow Wilson didn't want the media reporting on it. And as a result, people made terrible health decisions, like gathering for parades when an airborne virus was ripping through the world. And I think we also realize what a difference a strong, compassionate leader makes. FDR was really able to take America from a place where people believed that the world had no place for a cripple to a place where 7 million Americans were volunteering to fight against polio. And he managed to do that in under 25 years. Now, partly that was because he was afflicted with polio himself. I'm not saying that we need a president who goes out and gets the Zika virus and can share their story with everyone. But I do think that you need leaders who are very empathetic and very able to understand the plight of people who are suffering and motivate the rest of America to take up arms against the disease. So I don't know if we're in that place on all of those things right now.
Yes, your comments are very well timed. Maybe the opposite is true right now, unfortunately.
We might want to pray that a plague does not break out in the next 4 years.
Exactly. Well, let's talk a little bit about compassion and empathy and what we know and what we don't know, what your book will uncover about a disease like leprosy. We've all heard about leper colonies. Was that necessary, or what does this expose
no.
the lack of empathy and compassion felt at that time?
No, leper colonies weren't necessary. Leprosy is a really hard disease to catch. You have to be in constant close proximity with lepers to end up contracting it, which might happen if you are, you know, the mother or father of a leper, but it really will still take years to catch leprosy. It's very difficult. But the government was very, very pretty irrationally afraid about the threat that lepers posed to their society. And this meant that lepers in Hawaii were exiled to the Isle of Molokai. And what people often don't tell you about that is how horrific the conditions immediately became. The government just assumed that all these lepers would, you know, farm and tend to themselves. And if you have leprosy, you don't have a lot of feelings in your limbs. You've probably lost a few fingers. You might have lost a leg. You're not really in the best position to start a farm, especially if you weren't a farmer beforehand. So conditions fell apart on the leper colony really, really fast. There was a saying that I wish I could remember in the Hawaiian where people said, in this place, there are no laws. And it was really a very terrifying place to be. A lot of the people who visited described it as being like their conception of hell. And it really took a man of Father Damien's rare compassion to go to this island, see the conditions. And when he went, he was told, you're going to have minimal contact with the lepers. You're not going to touch them. You're going to administer death rites and, you know, give them some church sermons, but you'll never, ever come close to them. And Father Damien got to the island and realized that children had wounds that were bandaged, and the bandages were so untended that their wounds were crawling with worms. And Father Damien immediately began changing their bandages by hand. He started building houses. He built a church for them. He showed everyone how to farm. He started working with them to do the bulk of the heavy lifting on the farming. He started an orphanage so the children had some place to go, and gave them really wonderful, inspiring messages about how they were going to grow up, they were going to get married, they were going to have jobs. He really brought hope to this island. And, you know, in his lifetime, he was able to change it from a terrifying, lawless place into a very peaceful place. And he also contracted leprosy himself. But in the process, he was able to share the story of the lepers with the world. He was able to start raising funds for the island and all for a people who had essentially been completely abandoned by society.
Wow, that's quite a story. Well, take us from leprosy, something that we've heard a lot about, to one of these plagues that I've never heard about. But
oh,
this
good.
Is,
you're going to ask, because I was going to ask. I can't wait.
The dancing plague.
Everybody loves the dancing
in
plague.
In the 1500s. Talk about that.
Well, one day in Strasbourg, a woman began dancing uncontrollably, and she couldn't stop. And within a few weeks, 400 other people had followed her lead.
Now, that and happens here in Park City all the time. Maybe we have a dancing plague that's broken out. That sounds very familiar. We call that a street party.
Well, it sounds very fun until you realize that this was no ordinary dancing. People were dancing until bones were sticking out of their feet. They were dancing until they were having heart attacks. Their families would try to restrain them. They would break free of their bonds and just go on dancing. And this was also happening at a time when it was pretty popular to burn witches. And you could be burned as a witch if you had a mole in an odd place, or if you seemed uncommonly intellectual. So I thought, well, this is going to be a pretty short chapter. These people are just going to burn all these dancing people as witches. And what really shocked me was that was not the case. The village, which had very limited resources, allocated them towards trying to find all these different cures for these afflicted people. And they sent out messages from the town officials saying that everybody had to be really careful because they didn't want to take away a chance of recovery for their neighbors. And finally, they sent the afflicted people off to St. Vitus' shrine, and the people danced around it, and supposedly they recovered, and they went back to their normal lives. Now, I don't want to overestimate the curative properties of shrines. This was almost certainly an outbreak of mass hysteria, and sometimes if you believe that you have been cured by something that you have faith in when it comes to mass hysteria, you are cured. But I do think it's amazing that everybody in a town in 1518 really worried about their neighbors so much, really wanted to make sure that everyone got better and they didn't demonize them. Frankly, that's still something that we're a little behind on today.
Yes, we are. And let's flip to, since we're into storytelling, I have one. I mentioned it earlier, the 40,000 lobotomies between the 1930s and the 1970s, but a lot of them were performed by a particular doctor.
Walter Freeman Jackson, history's biggest monster.
There we go.
Walter Freeman Jackson drove across the country in a lobotomobile, promising people that his creation would cure everything from menopause to headaches to post-war depression, which a tremendous number of people were experiencing at that point. And he really preyed on everyone's vulnerabilities, seemingly as far as I can tell, because he loved being in the newspaper. He was just a really publicity-hungry narcissist who could never be convinced that the cons of lobotomies greatly outweighed the pros, even when he operated on people. And his post-operative papers say things like, Rose is a smiling, lazy, and satisfactory patient with the personality of an oyster. She pours and pours from an empty coffee cup. She cannot remember my name. And then when people like Rose, and this was a 29-year-old married woman, were returned to their families, and their families were understandably horrified and contacted Walter Freeman Jackson, he suggested that she was probably misbehaving and she might be in need of a good old-fashioned spanking followed by a dish of ice cream and a kiss and makeup. So it is almost unfathomable to me that Walter Freeman Jackson saw that his operation was turning people into toddlers and just kept on doing it. And he kept on doing it until the end of his life, when his medical license was revoked because he lobotomized the same woman three times.
Wow.
Yeah. yeah, don't always look at, if somebody is promising you something that sounds really good, always look at what the possible cons of that thing might be.
What was his motivation? Was he making a lot of money? Was it personal wealth?
Money,
gain?
Hand over fist.
Yeah.
And he was also, I think he got the Nobel Prize. Like, he really convinced a lot of people that he was the science of the future. And he also loved being written about. He loved talking to the press. He loved being famous. If only we had had reality television shows, he could have been on one of them, and then he wouldn't have gone around lobotomizing so many people.
Yeah, but there are other consequences to being on reality television that we won't go into on this show in this interview.
So talk a little bit. Oh, go ahead.
You know, if I want to be very kind to Walter Freeman Jackson, which I don't want to be because he seems like a pretty terrible person, I think you could say that sometimes you can be so close to your own creation that you can't see the downsides. I'm sure we've all have friends who have, you know, at least I have some friends who have given me a novel they're working on or their screenplay. And to me, it's evident that maybe this isn't great. But no matter what I say, they will never, ever believe that.
Right.
And you know, that's usually a very harmless inclination in general, unless it's in regards to lobotomies.
Right. You know, Jennifer, excuse me, in the beginning of the interview, I rattled off a handful of plagues and diseases that you treat, but I didn't talk about cholera or encephalitis lethargica or Spanish flu. And I'm just wondering if you go through, like, we hear about diseases and plagues, and I'm wondering if some run their course, if some are vaccinated against, and if some are treated with now a very simple antibiotic or something like that. What, you know, if you could do a quick survey of that, you know, does a plague ever just run its course and then stops presenting a threat?
I think the only one in this book that isn't treatable with antibiotics is, encephalitis lethargica isn't, but the biggest one and the scariest one is Spanish flu, because it was no ordinary flu. It was a flu that turned healthy immune systems against themselves. So most of the victims of Spanish flu in 1918 were people in their 20s or early 30s who were very healthy and had very robust immune systems and would get it and be dead within 24 hours.
Wow.
So that's a really terrifying prospect. Yeah, it was also airborne, which is the scariest way for diseases to present, because there's no way to avoid getting them. So Spanish flu ended up killing 50 million people worldwide. It killed 675,000 Americans, which is more Americans than have died in combat in all the wars we've ever fought. So the death totals across the world were staggering, and it just disappeared. Some people think that's because it killed so many hosts that it thought that there were no more to kill. We never figured out how to cure it. We never really figured out how to prevent against it very well, and it's still out there somewhere. So hopefully if it reoccurs, science will have come a long way since 1918 and maybe will be a little bit better at treating people who contract it. But it is very, very terrifying when you find a disease that we just don't know how to deal with.
Wow, that is pretty scary. So smallpox, for example, we know that with the inoculation or the vaccination, smallpox was eradicated. The last case of it, I don't know, was I think when I was a very young child, and I don't believe I had to be vaccinated against it. So that's, say 50-ish years ago. But I had never seen photos of smallpox victims. Wow.
Oh, it's horrific. Yeah, no, they're covered with pustules all over their body. It's and many of them also go blind as a result afterwards, and it leaves permanent scarring all over the bodies, which there was a comment in the book that death was the primary concern for men, and the ruination of one's beauty was the primary concern for women. So I'd like to think that, you know, maybe today it would be a little more equal between the sexes, but nobody wants to look as though they've had smallpox.
Right, right. One of my favorite books of all time, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, The Love in the Time of Cholera.
Time of Cholera.
And cholera, it is such a wonderful book. Cholera still exists in sort of the tropics, isn't that right?
Absolutely. There are many of these diseases that still exist in developing nations, and a lot of them have to, like cholera, have to do with problems of getting fresh, clean water. So there are things that anyone buying this book and reading this book would probably take completely for granted, and it's important to remember that they are not things that people in much of the world get to take completely for granted.
Right. And you do.
I mean, tuberculosis is another one that still exists that we never worry about.
Right. You do give a quote out of Love in the Time of Cholera in the beginning of your chapter on cholera, and I love it. The symptoms of love are the same as those of cholera. It's so painful.
I mean, I hope the symptoms of love are not quite the uncontrollable bowel movements that are produced by cholera. But yes, that's a great quote.
It is. Well, the book is called Get Well Soon, History's Worst Plagues and the Heroes Who Fought Them. Our guest is Jennifer Wright. Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us again. It's great to have you back.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hello, this is Reese DeMille with Republic Services, your local recycling and garbage pickup provider and a proud sponsor of KPCW's This Green Earth. Garbage and recycling containers should be placed at the curb before 7 a.m. on your scheduled collection day. Keep Summit County green. SummitCounty.org/recycle.
Hi, I'm Michael Manning, the director of golf at Park Meadows Country Club, a proud KPCW supporter. We've planned an active season of golf events, clinics, and lessons for all players on our Jack Nicklaus course, minutes from Park City Main Street. More information at parkmeadowscc.com.
Well, if you don't know anything about running with Ed, you're to be congratulated for your ability to completely disconnect from, at a minimum, local media and quite possibly local society as a whole. But assuming neither of these is your goal, I hope you will find this preview of this year's 38-mile 10-leg race, which raises money for the Park City Education Foundation and is celebrating its 8th anniversary, to both be informative and beneficial. I'm joined by Wendy Cohn, and we're hoped to be joined by Summer Sanders Schlope, but
yes,
we'll
Summer's
see.
On her way.
She's on her way. So, Wendy, for the time being, until we are joined by Summer, welcome to the Mountain Life.
Thank you so much for having me.
And so, you know, we're sitting here on a rainy day, a rainy Wednesday, and I know weather plays a big role. And Bob was just reminding me that last year was kind of a wet and cold event, and there's nothing we can do about the weather. But this event goes on, rain or shine, and you do fill it up, do you not?
Yes, our event does happen rain or shine. I think last year was probably some of the worst weather we had, but the best part about it was that we saw so many smiling faces and everybody was having a great time despite the weather.
Doesn't that kind of add to the whole
getting muddy
of this
and wet?
Thing? Yeah.
Yeah, it definitely adds to it. People just have a great time. It's such a great community event. So
I know I ran in one of the early ones, and it was quite wet and windy and cold, and it didn't seem to dampen the enthusiasm.
No, it doesn't. I mean, like I said, everybody has a great time. I was out there in the rain kind of checking in all the exchanges last year, and everybody coming in had these big smiles on their faces at all the exchanges. So I don't think weather, you know, is going to stop running with Ed from being an amazing experience.
And this thing's a whopper of a fundraiser, is it not?
It is.
What's your projected, I mean, you must have a goal, a target that you'd
right.
like to raise.
We do. Last year we raised over $260,000 that went back to Park City Education Foundation that ultimately then funds programs at our schools and for our teachers and our students. So we're able to basically provide a lot of programs based off of the money that is raised with this event.
And these are programs that wouldn't otherwise happen, or are you enhancing existing programs?
So basically what we do is we raise over $1 million every year that goes back to these different programs that we provide. We have a whole process that we look at, you know, to see what kinds of programs we would like to provide. It's based on teacher input. It's based on, you know, a lot of different factors and what the student needs are. And so, as you probably know, the state funding with Utah, there is a big gap as far as what
right.
they provide in funding. And so what we try to do is bridge that gap.
And that $1 million that you put back into the system annually, you know, and when we hear the metrics on where Utah stands on per pupil standing, we never rank well. We're at the bottom.
I will say Park City is the best in the state, and we're very proud of that.
Right.
But yes, Utah does not rank well overall. But we are, like I said, trying to make it so that we are coming in at a much higher level and not base it on the state level.
Right. So this is really critical funding, and this event represents a quarter of the funding that you put back into the system
every year.
So give us the details. You're promoting it. There's registration deadlines. Let's go over just the nuts and bolts of this thing.
So Running With Ed this year is on May 20th. We're expecting sunshine and warm temperatures like we've seen earlier this week. Would be lovely. We are in the middle of our registration period, and registration has been going really well. If you're a team captain and sign up your team, you're getting a free pair of Reebok running shoes from our founding partner, Ragnar and Reebok. They've come together, and we had in our early bird registration, we had free shoes, and that went so well. They were so impressed that they have extended it and given us another 110 pair of shoes.
Wow, that's a nice little incentive.
It is a great incentive.
And talk about the Ragnar relationship to this event.
Yes. So the other big component is Ragnar is a huge supporter and founding partner for us, and they are doing a Ragnar grant that is basically, it's based on participation. The school with the most participation wins $5,000, and then we have a second and third place prize of $3,000 and $2,000. It's simply based on school participation. When you register, you click on which school that you'd like to, you know, apply your registration toward, and then that school will accumulate points. So right now we're in this big push for registration to get all our schools participating and, you know, people in the area participating and base it on a school. So it just helps. It's added free money for your schools, and we're very appreciative of Ragnar for that grant.
And is there a final deadline for registration?
Yes. So we have our regular registration, which goes until the 14th of April, and then we have an extended late registration. The prices do go up. There's less incentives there to get in that late time. So you definitely want to take advantage of your registration right now.
And who's the target audience for Running With Ed? I mean, I've done it, and I didn't have kids in the school system at that time. My kids are a bit older, so they were through it, and I just did it because it was fun, and I got invited twice to run on different teams and had a blast. I mean, it's a really fun event, but I can see how parents with kids in the school system might be the low-hanging fruit, but how far does this go out into the community?
So you can be any age to run Running With Ed. You don't have to be a skilled, experienced, trained runner. You can be, you know, a kindergartner. You could be a grandparent. In fact, Summer's just joining us.
Our typical Park City mom just joined us.
Racing all over the place. In this rain. Who would have thought we'd have rain?
It was just for you, Summer.
Thank you.
But what I was going to segue with Summer is Summer had a team which her kids were on in the team. Her family members were all on the team, and she also had a big team.
There's a lot of family members
on the team. Yeah.
Yeah, so everyone from Mimi, who's a proud 70-year-old, all the way down to my son at the time, who was 8. So, yeah, and they all ran their own legs.
Yeah, 10 legs. You get to break it up that way.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, they and you know what? They finished, and they were so proud of themselves. not just because they did the race, but they knew what the race was all about, that it was for their education, it was for a purpose. And I always say it's so fun. I mean, parents, kids, teachers, community members are sweating for our kids' education. It's so much better than buying candy bars, which was the old school fundraiser.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that is true. And it is a fun event, and it does kind of ripple out into a broader community. And, of course, the school district's broader than just Park City and encompasses mm-hmm. a lot of Summit County. Do you get people outside of the school district? Do you get people coming from the east side of the county or other counties? And do you track that?
We do. We get a lot of support from Salt Lake. Because Ragnar does the Wasatch Back, we get a lot of participants through that. Salt Lake Running Company and some of the other running businesses down in Salt Lake. And then we also do get support from Heber and Midway. And you see a lot of runners come in from all over. And it's not just...
Isn't there that group? Where did you say they come from? Every year they show up. I mean, it's like a plane ride away, I feel like.
Oh, you know, I'm not familiar with
that. Okay. Well, anyway, there are groups. Yeah, definitely. I mean, people who love to run, this is a really fun adventure that doesn't take an entire weekend. It's one day, and it really pushes your limits in some sections. Others aren't that bad, especially from Jeremy to Ecker. Mm-hmm. But people really love that. I call it like the social competitiveness. You know, a lot of us are longing for that little bit of like that competitive juice to flow. And this is a really fun way to do it. So that's why we do get a lot of people from all over the valley, because they really love running. We have a really strong running community here. It's a little bit of trail, a little bit of road, all for a good reason.
And it's got a little bit of Tour de Suds in it, too. There are a lot of
exactly.
costumes in this event.
Because
exactly. yes. I wore a tutu, and that was probably seven
years
ago.
The costumes are fantastic. Last year, I don't know if you saw pictures, but the pinatas and the Day of the Dead and
the
Tooth
Dead
Fairies.
Park,
I mean, it's so fun. It's so fun.
See, and I'm a California girl, and so we would do the Beta Breakers every year with my dad. And so that's like the original dress-up race. And it's crazy, and it's fun, and it's a weird distance in 7 miles. But I think it brings just a little bit of all the great races together in this awesome town of Park City.
So we've got 3 minutes or so, maybe a little under. Let's talk about this men running for Ed and what they're attempting to do, because that was kind of a new component of Running for Ed that I just learned about today.
So Men for Ed is our group of dads in Park City that are trying to build a $1 million endowment. And that endowment is going to be funding specifically after-school programs so that these children that are in the school district have some kind of outlets after school. And these dads just want to volunteer. They want to get involved. So our Men for Ed group, which is growing in membership, we're trying to get to 1,000 members, they participate in Men for Ed, or Running with Ed, by having a Men for Ed team every year. So we're excited to have that group on again this year. We're looking to grow that membership. And so, yeah, they're just a great group of dads giving their time.
Are they growing the membership by running as a group and that's the goal? Or does their running as a group, does their fundraising then translate into the endowment?
They're basically running as a group, and it's just to show their support for PCEF.
Right.
And then just to clarify, too, it's not just dads, because the Women's Giving Fund, I mean, I bought a spot for my daughter. So it's any man in Park City that is connected somehow and wants to be a part of the group.
Right. Final minute, let's just review quickly again the nuts and bolts of registration, and it happens May 20th.
Yep, the event May 20th. You just go on to runningwithed.com. Go ahead and follow our registration links on Eventbrite there and get yourself signed up. Allocate your school, and then you participate in the Ragnar Grant.
Great. Wendy, Summer, thanks for joining us on The Mountain Life. Good luck with the event.
Thank you so much.
Have a good day.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air, Cruise, and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Park City Bike Demos, Kearns Boulevard next to Adolph's, parkcitybikedemos.com. Long, Reimer, Weiniger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
You're listening to KPCW Park City at 91.7 and 88.1 FM in Summit County and 91.9 FM in Wasatch County.
Coming up on 10:01, back to the music here, by the way. Rain showers today with highs just in the 50s. It's 10:01.